What changes might come to Florida's Constitution? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Every 20 years, 37 people are appointed to Florida's Constitution Revision Commission to discuss potential amendments to the state's constitution. They listen to ideas from the public as well as put their own together for the voters to decide. There are hundreds of ideas so far. Which ones will likely end up on the ballot? And let's face it, there are few experiences like getting a big pastrami sandwich from the deli. You'll likely have a favorite deli in your community. Today, we take a look at one very successful Miami deli that took a bad Yelp review and made it part of its identity. All of that on Sundial today. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, we've arrived at that point every 20 years when we ask a group of people to come together and help modernize our state constitution. The group is called the Constitution Revision Commission. Now, they listen to residents' ideas and thoughts about potential amendments. Then they, of course, propose their own ideas for amendments. When it's all said and done, the commission will propose a series of amendments that will go on the 2018 ballot for voters to decide on. We're joined now by Sergio Bustos of Politico Florida to help us understand what some of those amendments could be and what the commission is doing right now. Sergio, pleasure to have you on the program.
Good afternoon, Luis. Thanks for the invitation.
And by the way, he's joining us from our studios in Doral at the Miami Herald. So remind us why Florida revises its constitution every couple decades.
Well, yeah, it's put together once every 20 years to hear from the public about any recommended changes to the state constitution. And then any of these proposals that pass the commission's final vote will be placed on the general election ballot come November 6, 2018, which is really just around the corner. And then if it when it goes on the ballot, they must secure at least 60% of the vote approval to become law. So it's got a lot of different thresholds to reach.
Now, the political leadership chooses most of the commission members. And right now in Florida, that leadership is pretty much all Republican. So who's on the commission?
It's any number of experts from people from both sides of the aisle. But as you point out, the majority of the commissioner members are chosen by the governor, Governor Rick Scott, who's a Republican, by the Senate president, who is a Republican, and by the House Speaker, who's also a Republican. And some of them have sprinkled in different people from, like I said, different points of view. But by and large, it's driven by the party in power. And in Florida, that's the GOP.
And just taking a preliminary look at it, of the 37 members, I have to verify this, 30 of them are Republican?
Yes, I think that's correct. Yeah, it's majority driven by those three entities I mentioned: the governor, the Senate, and the House.
Members of the public were able to submit amendments, and a lot of people have, but very few were chosen by the commissioners. Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, this is still an ongoing process. The second round of public hearings is going to begin in February. And they'll start here in Fort Lauderdale. They're going to have an event at Nova Southeastern University on Tuesday, February 6th. And just to give you an idea how long these meetings are, they've set aside 6 hours for public testimony. I mean, this is really diehard government folks, political wonks, policy wonks and the like. But as to your question, it's a process that's just driven by, really think about it, every 20 years, the world's changed quite a bit in 20 years. So there's just going to be, when the party in power is kind of driving the train or driving the bus on this, it's going to have its leanings more to be more conservative, if you will.
Take us through what it's like at one of those meetings. I mean, as you said, it's going to take hours because you're going to have a lot of people who are pitching a lot of ideas, and they have looked at a lot. Mm-hmm. But I could just walk up and I have my turn I guess, up at the mic, and I could say, I want to see an amendment on, it could be on anything. Maybe I don't want us to grow green tomatoes anymore in Florida. but is it as simple as it like a city commission meeting, everybody jumps up and just throws their ideas out there?
You know, and I hate to say an idealistic about this, but it is the beauty of America that it is a very democratic process. Now, you may argue back and forth, okay, as we just mentioned, it's dominated by Republicans. But on the other hand, it is a chance for folks to come up, speak their mind. They get their few minutes. It's not necessarily a few minutes of fame, because not the whole world's not necessarily listening. But you do have a choice commission of 37 members listening to all the proposals, and they get pitched. And yes, there's a great deal of during the public hearings, it was just a huge number of issues that were outlined. I do have to give credit to the public in this one. You know, sometimes, you know, they don't necessarily show up for elections, but they had a lot of folks come out for these marathon public hearings. And just to give you an idea, there are currently 782 public proposals. These are proposals pitched by, you know, Joe Q or Jose Q Citizen. In a place like Florida.
Wait, let me back up. You said, something you said that you might not see people go to the polls to vote, but they will go and sit for hours as people pitch their ideas to this commission?
Yes, these are diehard. These meetings, there's not a ton of them held all over the state, but they do hold them all over the state. And the turnout's been quite large. You get a number of people going. I'm not sure if they can keep it up, but again, the new round of hearings will come up in February, and they've had 782 public proposals, and then the commissioners also can pitch their own proposal, and they've had about 103. So you're looking at, nearly 900 proposals to get on the ballot for November 2018.
We're talking with Sergio Bustos of Politico Florida, and we're talking about the Constitution Revision Commission. As mentioned, this is a group of people appointed, and they get together every 20 years to basically look at potential amendments to our state constitution. And as we just heard from Sergio, that they do have public meetings, and they want to hear the public's ideas for amendments. And there's another one coming, as he mentioned. It's going to be at Nova Southeastern University, Tuesday, February 6th, from 1 to 7 o'clock. So everybody can come and share their ideas. Go ahead, Sergio.
Yeah, I was just going to say they can also visit the Constitution Revision Commission website. I'm not going to give you the whole name of it, but just, you know, like everyone else, just plug that into Google, put Florida, and you'll come up with their website, and they have a lot of information there about all the upcoming meetings.
All right, so they get all of these ideas from the public, and of course, you know, the commissioners will come up with their own ideas. And it seems like they're popping out amendments. Again, they still have to be voted on, but they're popping out these ideas for amendments every so often. But how do they take the public's ideas? How do they mesh it with their own? How do they formulate what could be the amendment that shows up on the ballot?
Well, you know, it's all in the writing process in terms of what's pitched and what's offered. But I'll give you an idea. Two of the most kind of most discussed subjects or debated during the Constitution Revision Commission public hearings over the past year involved two major issues. One is the restoration of rights for felons. There's a number of proposals that came from the public, and even several commissioners have filed their own proposals on it. And this is a very straightforward one. As you know, in Florida, anyone who's convicted of a crime and ends up doing time in prison, the process to be able to vote again is a lengthy one, and really there's a huge barricade to doing so. There's been a movement both in Tallahassee to get legislation passed. So this is another path supporters are taking to be able to restore the rights of felons to vote again. And so they're going through the CRC or this commission to get that done. Again, there have been several proposals offered. Whether they get through the kind of the first hurdle, which is getting the commission to approve language, we'll see. The other one is another one hotly debated is it's called E-Verify. The federal government has a database where they can they have the numbers of, you know, Social Security numbers of everyone, so that when you apply for a job, an employer, right now it's voluntary, but an employer would check that database to see if you're in the country legally and that you can legally work for them. they've gotten a ton of proposals on this topic alone. Some 600 have been offered up. And in response, one CRC commissioner has, in fact, filed a proposal so they can, you know, dig further into it. And again, that would make it a requirement that employers check this federal database. And again, they call it E-Verify, to see if they're the prospective employee they're looking to hire is here in the country, you know, legally or not.
So as they're working on the language, again, to decide whether or not this could be a potential amendment, you know, we back up a little bit. Again, there's hundreds, more than 100 ideas right now, and there have been hundreds of pitches.
Yes.
So the first commission had barely half a dozen, I believe. The very first commission in 1977 had barely half a dozen amendments. None of them were voted for, or all voted down, I should say. The second commission in 1997-98 had 9 amendments that they put on the ballot. 8 were voted for. I mean, is it just basically we can expect somewhere between half a dozen to 10 amendments possibly on the ballot? They really don't want more than that, do they?
No, and you know, let's be honest. I remember a few years ago, I can't recall the year, I think it was 2008, the ballot was, you know, it was like reading, reading the Constitution itself all over again. And you know, you can't burden voters with that many. So they will kind of keep it to a minimum. But it's a lot like when bills are offered up in Congress or in Tallahassee. You know, each year, for instance, in Tallahassee, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of bills offered. At the end of the day, they don't pass that many. And so they do go through this, you know, if you will, a vetting process. And this is exactly what's happening here with the commission.
Remind us real quickly, though, why have a commission give us amendments when if the people really want something, you know, they can gather the signatures, they can push to have an amendment on the ballot. Lawmakers can push to have amendments on the ballot. Why have a commission do that?
Well, it's just another avenue of the democratic process. It's been around a long time, and as you said, you can gather up signatures like they did with medical marijuana, gather up the signatures, put it on a ballot. But remember, even the medical marijuana vote was driven by John Morgan, an attorney, a trial attorney up in Orlando, who had the money to actually back up the gathering of the signatures and the like. This is another avenue that would not necessarily require the financial effort to put something on the ballot. It's just another avenue, I'd say.
Again, talking with Sergio Bustos of Politico Florida, we're talking about the Constitution Revision Commission. They are meeting again throughout this year and into next year, and they will decide perhaps however many amendments will go on the ballot for next year. They're looking at it now. Again, this is a group that only comes together every 20 years. We'll talk about some of those other potential amendments and some of the other things that this commission does. That's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. I'm joined by Sergio Bustos of Politico Florida. He's joining us at the studios in the Doral at the Miami Herald. And again, we're talking about the Constitution Revision Commission. And again, this is a group of people appointed to these posts every 20 years. And they come together and they come up with ideas for potential amendments to go on the ballot. Obviously, they go and they listen to you, the taxpayers, the citizens of Florida, to find out your thoughts, your ideas. Sometimes they take your ideas. Those may become amendments. And again, they are going to be holding another public hearing coming up here in South Florida. It's going to be at Nova Southeastern University Tuesday, February 6th. Of course, when we get closer to that, we will remind you again. You know, Sergio, let's talk about some of these ideas that are on the list right now. Again, more than 100 right now that they're looking at, and there could be more coming. There's a proposed constitutional ban on oil and gas drilling in Florida's coastal waters. First of all, wasn't there already a conversation about this on a federal level, and what's going on with this one?
Yeah, and on the federal level, that's an ongoing one. There's been talk of late that the Trump administration wants to revisit this and open up the waters to oil drilling at least on the Gulf Coast of Florida. But no, this one is a proposed constitutional ban, as you mentioned, on oil and gas drilling in Florida's coastal waters. It was approved by by a committee of the CRC. So it's kind of overcome one step. You know, right now, drilling in state waters is banned under state law, and placing the ban in the Constitution would help. What supporters say is prevent oil spills that threaten the Florida coast and our tourist economy. It's passed its first hurdle, but it's gotten some opposition from industry as well.
And you mentioned this before, but just as a reminder, so for an idea to become an amendment that's going to be put on the ballot by this commission, how many people on the commission have to vote for it?
Well, it's got to be a majority, so it's 37 members, but it also has to get through all these the several committees. So a particular proposal will have to get through several committees to finally get to a vote. So it's not overdone. But and then remember, then it's got to get onto the ballot and then get 60% of voters to approve it, and that has always been a pretty large hurdle.
All right, talking about the environment, there's a proposal that would require one-third of the land acquisition trust fund go toward Florida Forever land conservation. Where is that? This, again, a very hotly debated issue.
Yeah, and this goes back to that's really been a problem in the state is where to put all the money that's been generated over the years through certain legislations already passed. And, you know, I hate to say it, but this is one of those that's just going to end up in the courts. I'm not sure where it's going to go in the CRC, but there's just so much kind of dispute over this particular one that it faces a really long road to ever getting figured out. And, again, this won't be the only stop on the way to the difficulty it's had. They did pass, I think it got past one committee, but there's another one that hasn't gotten through. It's just been an endless kind of legislative and legal battle on this front.
And you know what I was just thinking about, too, is that obviously with the legislative session coming up, you know, lobbyists play a big role in how lawmakers are working deals and passing bills. But do lobbyists play any role, by the way, in this commission?
Well, the connections they have with different lawmakers and others who've been appointed certainly play some role. But again, it's such a long road that you'd have to get this through this commission first and then onto the ballot. But there is certainly plenty of lobbying and jockeying going back and forth in different groups. You mentioned this environmental one. I mean, there are folks on both sides of that argument that have argued vehemently one side or the other in front of the commission.
Saw one that was very interesting, an education proposal, this one dealing with, one of them is creating term limits for school board members and also how superintendents are picked. And this is a lot of people in education have kind of spoken up about this. They got a problem with it.
Yes. This is interesting because, you know, years ago, the voters were really wanted to impose term limits on legislators. There's always been talk of that, of doing that, but in Washington, because, you know, if you recall, this Michigan lawmaker, John Conyers, had been in office since practically the day I was born, and I was born in 1962. So the idea was they wanted to impose term limits, and this would just take it down to that level of school board member. And again, the idea of supporters would be, look, when you leave these folks in power so long, they assume it's their right to hold office. So that proposal actually advanced on what it was its second committee stop at the commission. But they tweaked it a little bit to make it, I think, retroactive. So
I think about that one, and then I look at some of the other ones, and there's some that deal with, like, high-speed rail, Greyhound racing, even vaping. And I'm wondering, do we need an amendment for those, or couldn't those just be handled by, you know, just by the legislature or even local laws?
Well, Lewis, now you've hit it right on the head, and this is where they got argued back and forth, and this is what the commission will say. Hey, you know, this is really not the kind of issue that should go on a statewide ballot. These are issues that would be better settled, locally, or that the legislature should really take on. It's absolutely true.
And of course, let's see, I'm going to try to get through a couple of these. There's a proposed amendment and the death penalty. Do you think that's going to go anywhere?
You know, just like anything in life, it's one of those that have been argued for a long, long time. I don't think that one has any chance of getting onto the ballot.
Let's see. One would create a commission to draw electoral districts. This, again, another very heated debate instead of letting the legislature do that. How do the voters feel about that one?
Well, you know, when you ask people on the surface, they would agree. But then when you actually lay out language to see exactly what the amendment would say, then you get people disagreeing all the time. Again, that's one of those I see hitting a wall at this commission.
What amendments do you think are going to show up on the ballot? Or, you know, one or two that you think have the best chance that we're going to see?
You know, I really would struggle. I don't want to, I don't like to be predicting so much in the future there, but I will say that I think the two I mentioned at the top of the list, the restoration of rights for felons, I think that's one that might get through because it was, again, it was the most discussed subject. Maybe not to the liking or necessarily leanings of the more conservative commission. On the other hand, it's putting it out to voters, so they might go ahead and put that one on. And I wouldn't be surprised if the E-Verify got out there. On the other hand, if E-Verify, this is the one that would require employers to check a federal database to see if folks are here illegally. I think even if it got on the ballot, there could be, again, court fights, legal battles of how it's done, because there's a lot in how the language of the amendment or ballot is issued. And then, of course, the legislature would have to come up with money to help fund such a program. It gets a little complicated. The other one I think is it would be kind of interesting. You mentioned the school board ones, I think, are the most interesting because I didn't even realize that there was this, I guess, debate over elected versus appointed superintendents. But apparently in more rural school districts, smaller ones, you know, it is the case that they're elected, so there's a sense of some accountability to voters. And it really is local government. So, I would not be surprised about seeing that.
I do want to mention, by the way, that tomorrow on the program, we're going to get some historical perspective on the Florida Constitution revision process. We hear from a member of the last commission. That was 20 years ago. You know what, Sergio, I can't let you go without asking. We're going to switch gears here a little bit and just talk a little bit about Tallahassee politics. You know, I wanted to know, first of all, what's happening right now in Tallahassee and really around Florida with Republicans, considering what happened in Alabama with Roy Moore? How has that impacted the upcoming 2018 election?
This is an interesting Senate race that happened there, because if you listen to Democrats, they're looking at it as a harbinger of things to come, of good things to come for the party. Republicans, on the other hand, are very cautious and saying, hey, look, this was a flawed, I should say deeply flawed candidate. I mean, let's face it, the man was accused of child molestation, and that they shouldn't see it as a harbinger. I'm not sure. I think what I would read in this is, and I think what both parties will agree on, is turnout. Because he was backed by Trump, at least in the general election, keep in mind, President Trump did not back Moore in the primaries. He backed his opponent, Strange, the gentleman, I can't recall his first name offhand, but he was backing his opponent. But I think that's where you see that it really ignited and really triggered a turnout among Democratic voters. Even though, I will say this, the Trump supporters are very passionate, and they came out big, too, for Moore. But the Democratic turnout, I think, is the thing maybe to look for, that anytime President Trump is going out there, you know, in favor of a certain candidate, it's just going to really turn on the Democratic voter against him. And from what I understand, Trump is going to be on the campaign trail all throughout 2018, visiting the entire country.
And Luther Strange is the guy that
Luther,
you're talking
yes.
about. Just real quickly, in the short time that I have, obviously, you know, there's just been a lot of rumor. Everybody's basically been waiting. Is Governor Rick Scott going to jump into the Senate race against the incumbent? Do you think this changes his mind? Senator Bill Nelson, by the way, is the incumbent. I mean, does this change the governor's mind?
No. Again, if you know, obviously, Governor Rick Scott is not this Alabama, you know, not a poor candidate. In fact, Scott's got a great, you know, in his eyes, a very strong record to run on. He can talk about jobs. He can talk about what he's done to Florida's economy, and but he's also got a lot of things that. Remember, he only won both elections by less than 1% statewide. That's going to be a very close contest.
When is he going to announce?
You know, he can announce. You know, he does have a deadline. I think later, and I think somewhere mid-year. But he could announce as early as March next year and early next year. He could announce any time, and he's made no. I think he's said that he doesn't want to be driven by what the pundits and media does, but he will eventually be announcing. I think it's a foregone conclusion. What else would he do?
Sergio Bustos of Politico Florida, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for joining us today,
and thank you for the invitation.
All right, coming up next, what makes for a great deli? I'm going to get your taste buds going on this next segment. All of that coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, so take some Jewish comfort foods like matzo ball soup and potato latkes. Mix in some very non-traditional ingredients like lobster and chili peppers. And you have an idea of the menu at Josh's Deli and Appetizing in Surfside. We recently spoke with Josh Marcus, owner of Josh's Deli, which he calls a Jewish deli done wrong. And he told us how he comes up with some of those menu items, as well as his ideas about what makes for a really good deli. What do you do wrong at Josh's Deli?
Well, I guess it stems from a Yelp review that I got maybe like 5 months after I opened. My deli is very small. So maybe I can fit 25 people in it. And most of the time, delis are like gigantic, cavernous places. And the first year I was open, I got... into Bon Appetit magazine, and it was Christmas week, which is just crazy in South Florida, and I was running out of food at like 1:30 because I was doing like 100 people in my 25 seat restaurant, and I had a family of six show up at literally like 1:45, and I was like, listen guys, I'm really sorry, I have no more food. And they looked at me like, you know, like I just like stole a baby. And I was like, I'm really, really sorry. I was like, come back tomorrow. I'll hook you up, blah, blah, blah. They didn't do that. They just went on Yelp. They went on every single review site and wrote like the same review. They were like, this place is tiny. It's a fake deli. And like just ripping me apart for what is essentially a good thing. Like I ran out of food because I was so busy and people like were enjoying what they were coming for. So I just kind of took that and like, instead of being like, oh, I'm a fake deli, I was like, I'm a fake deli. So I started that whole process of like doing deli wrong and everything like that. Also, I sell things like lobster knishes and...
I want to get to your menu.
Yeah.
I want to get to your menu. The full name, by the way, is Josh's Deli and Appetizing.
Yeah.
Why the adjective?
Well, to understand what delis are, delis were normally the places where Jews went to go get meat products, and appetizing stores were where they went to go get fish and cheese products, because you can't combine the cheese with the meat. So, but I was not kosher. So I was doing, when I first opened up, I was doing cured salmon, I was doing sable fish, I was doing like cured mackerel, different types of fish, but I was also serving corned beef and pastrami, roast beef. So it's a deli and it's appetizing.
You grew up in the New York suburbs.
Mm-hmm. So Marcia.
I'd imagine you had great experiences at delis.
It's interesting. I grew up in that time frame where I think the deli was starting to die. So in New York City, when I was growing up, you had Katz's and Second Avenue Deli and Carnegie and Stage and like all of those great places. But I lived in New Rochelle where I had like the one local deli. And what really Delhi had become maybe in the 70s and 80s is really like sandwich shops or that section of your supermarket where it sold cold cuts. It wasn't the store where you can find lots of weird items from all over Eastern Europe or like what is it, Sunny Isles today. Like you can go to Sunny Isles and find some really strange stuff in some of those Russian delis, which is what a delicatessen really is. So when I was growing up, I had, you know, my next door neighbor was the waitress at the local deli, and I grew up there.
You were a chef at a number of very successful restaurants. Why did you want to break out and open a deli?
I have that creative impulse, and I have like that inert desire to not listen to anybody. So as much as I loved my chefs and I loved all of my old chefs, I couldn't stand listening to what they were trying to tell me or do. Or I worked for pretty big corporations, and that corporate life was not for me.
What are the things about a deli you wanted to make sure that you got right?
I do almost everything from scratch. Almost every single item on my menu I make. I have my hand in it. So I wanted to make sure that I got the pastrami right and the corned beef right, which I buy and cure everything, smoke it all in house. I make the
you
rub.
You smoke and cure your own meats.
Yeah, we cure all the briskets for 10 to 14 days. I make my own pastrami rub. I smoke them for 4 or 5 hours and then steam them. We make our own bacon, which is not very kosher. I'm told it's not kosher, whatever. We cure our own salmon. We make our own bagels. I make my own rye. I make different types of breads like ciabatta, semita rolls for different sandwiches that I make. I wanted to get those things right because, to me, the uniqueness of doing something yourself is what separates a restaurant. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's good all the time, but being unique and having its own unique flavor, I believe, puts a stamp on the dining experience. So if someone comes from somewhere else, say they're visiting, my rye bread's unique. It's not like every other rye bread. My salmon is unique. It's not like every other cured salmon. Whether it's the best one you've had or it's horrible, you'll remember that uniqueness. And I think that that's really what my selling point is.
And how did you know that you got it right? I mean, is it just simply a matter of your customers in what they told you, or is it something you knew? Like, this is exactly what it should be, I know. So, you know, that's how I want it.
No, I'm not formally trained. So I really operate under trial and error. I'm not afraid to fail.
Having said that, what's the hardest meat to perfect?
I mean, getting the pastrami right. I mean, the first couple ones of pastrami, I was my mouth was on fire from all the peppercorns, and I had to realize that I had to dial that back. And, like, it's all of them are hard. Not making a corned beef too salty and knowing how to fix the problem. If sometimes you buy a case of briskets, and one piece will be 14 pounds and another piece will be 9 pounds. So if you cure them all for 14 days, the 9-pound piece is going to be way too salty. So you need to know how to unsalt it without destroying it. So leaving it in water and letting osmosis do its thing and that type of stuff, fixing those problems.
How about bagels? You make your own bagels.
Yeah, we make our own bagels. It's another trial and error thing. Like basically, I just kept on working at it until I liked it. I'm super hard on myself. So,
what makes for a great bagel? And I think, sad to say, I've probably eaten just terrible bagels and have just told myself this is what a bagel tastes like.
Yeah, it's hard. Florida's really difficult place to produce good breads because it's the humidity level is just always there. What I look for in a bagel is when it's toasted, it can be a little bit crunchy on the outside but still soft and chewy on the inside. And if it's just right out of the oven, you won't get that like crunch, but it will still be nice and chewy.
I didn't even realize, maybe it's because I lived most of my life in Florida, I didn't even realize that about the humidity and that yeah. impacts breads.
Yeah, I mean, you can bake a perfect bread and then like an hour after it's baked, it becomes like way too chewy and like with nothing else to it. It's just like you're just chewing and your mouth gets tired, your jaw gets tired.
And was it the same thing as like with the meats, trying to get that bagel right? Did it take a lot of trial and error?
I think that I probably went through maybe 2 cases of meat before I was happy with what I was doing, before I had like a cure that I enjoyed, before I had a pastrami spice that I liked that was dynamic but not too sweet, not too spicy. So I did my research and just ate a lot.
All right, so I've heard that a big reason why those breads in New York and the bagels in New York are so good, it's the water. And I've heard that there are some chefs who will bring water from New York because they want that. Right. Is that a myth or is it true?
I mean, who am I to tell anybody that they're full of it? But from what I understand about the water in New York is that it's higher in magnesium than it is than Florida water. So what that will do to the bread is what that will do to the water is soften the water. So if you hear like a New York water, normally what they're doing is they're adding magnesium to Florida water, and that's what's happening.
Any thoughts on using low-fat cream cheese instead of regular cream cheese on your bagels?
Does that even exist? I don't even know.
You just refuse to accept that that's even a possibility.
That's
right.
Like the person who always orders that the Reuben sandwich with the Swiss cheese and the sauerkraut and then the Diet Coke. Or like you're like, what?
All right, sorry I asked that one. Because you talked about that one time you had the Christmas holiday that was really busy, but you know, being Hanukkah, you also find yourself really busy right this time of year?
No, but latke orders. I make a lot of latke orders. I've done enormous amounts of latkes the past couple of days. That's what happens at Hanukkah. You don't get, I mean, we're all getting busier in South Florida because of the nicer weather and season so forth. But no, Hanukkah, I'll sell 75, 100 latkes to like a party and that type of thing.
Is it a fun time of year for, you know, anyone in the food industry this time of year? I know obviously people in retail are the most important time of the year.
I can't speak for anyone else, but I'll tell you that as a person who cooks for a living and enjoys what they do, if you're not living for this busyness as a cook, you're probably doing the wrong thing with your life. The cooks that I know who love what they do and just love being ridiculously busy and like need to center themselves because they'll freak out if they lose control, they love the business and the busyness and like having a line at the door, and that thrill makes a good cook.
You've been hearing a conversation I had recently with Josh Marcus. He's the owner and founder of Josh's Deli and Appetizing in Surfside. We'll continue this conversation and our appreciation of delis coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We return to a conversation I had recently with Josh Marcus. He's the owner and founder of Josh's Deli and Appetizing in Surfside, as we continue our look and appreciation of delis.
What are some of your favorite items on your menu?
See, people ask me that all the time, and it's so cliche. I don't have favorites because I change my menu from week to week, sometimes from day to day.
Well, if you change it, do you ever find yourself like, I really don't like this, it's off the menu, I'm gone with it?
Sometimes a dish doesn't come out the way I like. Sometimes it comes out better, whatever. But what I find is that my clientele, the people that love coming to my deli, will try the new dishes because they're interested in trying what I'm doing. Like, for 6 years I've been doing this, and it's been like a journey between me and my guests. So people who've been coming to my restaurant for 6 years, they've seen many different things. As I've tried to learn about Mexican food, or if I've tried to learn more about Japanese food, I've included elements of those cuisines into deli food. By doing an example would be, what would be an example? Like the lobster knishes. But right now I'm doing a lot of Mexican-inspired stuff. I'm making cemita buns, and I'm combining Mexican flavors, chipotles, Oaxaca cheese, with different things like fried eggplant, or I'm doing a tuna dish. So it's what I like, and what I recommend is what I am doing now, and seeing if you're on board with that journey.
I wonder what it's like for you then. Are you just back there and you're just grabbing items to see? Because in your mind, you're thinking, these two might make an interesting fusion, maybe, maybe not. You're just throwing things together, or is it like a mad scientist trying to figure it out?
Cultures all have similar backbones when it comes to cuisine, but what's available to the culture at the time that, that they're coming up. So the difference between sauerkraut and kimchi is just the spice. They're both a fermented cabbage. So you can include elements of kimchi into anything that would work with the sauerkraut, and there you go. You have a brand new dynamic dish. So if you put kimchi on a Reuben, you have a spicy Reuben, and you're like, wow, this is amazing. But ultimately what that is the cultures use the same things, salt to cure something, sugar, and it's just what's available to them. Europeans didn't have chilies available, so they don't have a very spicy cuisine. Southeast Asia, lots of chilies. They have a spicier cuisine. Mexico has chilies. They have potatoes. So it's like just finding what each culture does that you can input into a different culture that seems to still work.
Anything on the menu that is maybe a favorite of your childhood?
I ate ketchup with spaghetti. Like, I couldn't sell that.
Really?
Yeah, I love my mother, but she was not the best cook.
Oh.
So
hopefully, you know, well, we won't insult anybody.
No, I think that that might be the reason why I like trying so many different things now and like seeing all these different things, because really, like, I'd say the first like 14 years of my life, I didn't have a very dynamic palate. But once I started discovering food, more like in college when I had like roommates from like Cambodia or cooks who people from New York City who did have dynamic palates, and they included me on that. I found that so fascinating. Now, I was an art major. I wasn't a cook by any stretch of the imagination, but I enjoyed that creative process. I had a lot of friends who cooked, so we would make nights of just cooking in college, and that's what got me rolling in this.
Interesting. How much study, though, did you get in cooking, in being a cook? Eventually, did you?
I never went to school for cooking.
No.
I worked like a dog. I worked three jobs for like 3 years, all different kitchens, different chefs. I read every single book that my sous chef would tell me to read. And I would ask every question that you could possibly imagine, because I was a sponge for like 3 years. So I was like, well, why does this happen? Why does this happen? And the best sous chefs were the ones who always knew the answers and had book recommendations.
Do you think that way of learning is better?
I can't speak to everybody. I'd be from the school of thought that if you're interested in something, you will learn it. So I was interested in learning about cooking, and I was a sponge for cooking. If I was in school for it, I can't guarantee that I would still have the interest in it when someone's teaching me, because I've already said I don't like being told what to do. So if someone's sitting there teaching me physically and I'm sitting in a class, I might have gotten bored and it might not have worked. But that's just the way I learn.
By the way, for those of us who don't know our way around the kitchen, remind people what a sous chef is.
A sous chef would be the second in command or the third in command under a chef.
You know, Miami and Miami Beach, of course, used to be famous for delis. You had Rascal House and Wolfie's, most of which have moved on or are gone altogether. Did you ever go to any of the legendary ones down here?
When I first moved here, like 18 years ago, Wolfie's was still there, and I lived 2 blocks away from it. So I would go to Wolfie's a lot. My uncle lives in Aventura, and I would go to Rascal House with him when I first moved. I'm not sure. My memory doesn't work so good. I don't remember when it closed, but I'm pretty sure I went there twice a year up until 2007, 2008.
And I think, what I was told too, because I didn't live here at the time, but it's that some of them were kind of fancy. Did you want to mimic any of that, or you've kind of gone in another direction? As you said, your place is small, but I don't know if you ever wanted to try to copy anything, success from other people.
No, I can't say that I ever had a model for what I wanted to do as far as what previous delis were.
Why'd you pick Surfside?
Honestly, I just love the space. The space in Surfside that we found, it was, to me, perfect, because it was small, and I felt like I could handle that, and it was an open kitchen. So I would be able to talk to people while I cooked. And that, to me, is the most important thing. I've often said that I don't work. I just rent a space where I play music and then cook for people, and they happen to pay me for it. And most of the time, I'll spend my day talking to people, having conversations about everything. I'm expecting a child. So every time someone walks in with a baby, I'm asking 1,000 questions right now. I'm talking about Bitcoin to people like for the past like 3 weeks. I'll talk about religion. I'll talk about politics. I don't really care. And I'll try to involve everyone. And we don't make it about animosity. It's just like you have a thought included in the conversation. We're all friends here. Don't worry about it. And it becomes a place where, like a bar, where you're talking and you're getting intellectually stimulated and you're eating a sandwich or drinking a coffee, and it becomes a fun experience for everyone involved.
And you're like the head bartender at Cheers.
Yeah.
You know what? You've been there a while and you've seen a lot of changes. I mean, that always had the Surfside always had that mom and pops feel, but towers are popping up all over the place. Mm-hmm. How much has everything changed? And what do you think about that?
Well, Surfside's a fantastic town. It's very unique in all of Miami because it's still a walking town. You can go to the supermarket, you can go to CVS from your house without your car, unless it's 100 degrees outside in summer. But it's just a great little town inside of a very large place. And I think that I know a lot of the population of Surfside. We're very close. I don't think that would have been possible in, say, South Beach. I don't think it would have been possible in, like, Coral Gables or anything else. Those places are big. And Surfside is small and intimate, and it allows me to be part of that community. The mayor and I are very close. They have their weekly meeting on Thursdays at my deli. It just harkens back to something that I would imagine in, like, Little House on the Prairie or something.
That's an interesting comparison. Not one I would think, but okay. You know, I mean, considering where you are, plans for the future. I mean, what's your ambition? What's your goal? Or is it to keep this going as it is?
Yeah, no. I love what I do. I don't really want to be Josh's Deli everywhere. I don't want to go to other places. For example, the most interesting thing I had was someone talking to me about doing something in Detroit, but it was, to me, what was interesting was like it was like charity work, like going to Detroit, which is hurting, but going to train people and giving them livelihoods and jobs under the guise of Josh's Deli. That to me is interesting. It's not so much about me going to Detroit and doing what I do in Surfside. I couldn't do what I do in other places. I couldn't enjoy it in the same way. I'm not a boss. I don't want to be a boss.
But the idea of franchising is
No. That's not something I'm interested in at all because that's not what I do. I'm not lying when I say I want to talk to people. I want to be part of their lives. I want them to be part of mine. And that journey is what's important to me. It's not about making money. It's not about having a job. It's not about having employees. It's to me, it's much more about a journey that I'm going through. And my menu from week to week is part of that journey. It's like That's the blockchain of it. That's the history of it.
Well, we've been talking with Josh Marcus. He's the owner of Josh's Deli and Appetizing. And go ahead and tell everybody where you're at.
We're located at 9517 Harding Avenue in Surfside.
And it's a little place, as you said, but a very cozy little place.
Yeah, it's pretty small. We don't even have a sign. You got to look for it. Don't tell people where it is because it might get overrun.
And he'll run out of food by 1:45. Hey, Josh, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And again, that's Josh Marcus, owner of Josh's Deli and Appetizing. And you can check out more about him and his menu at our website, WLRN.org. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.